podcast this week, we are joined by a driver. Yes, it's Michael Fassbender, star of Next Goal Wins and David Fincher's A Killer, returning to filmmaking after years off spent driving. Plus, we're also joined by a driver. Yes, it's Adam Driver, star of Michael Mann's Ferrari, in which he doesn't do any driving. Anyway, all that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that has discovered official Wonka tie-in chocolate toothpaste and is saying goodbye to its teeth. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, which is once again being recorded remotely at locations scattered across the UK. I am in Northern Ireland, and my two colleagues of such lethal cunning are in their homes, respective homes. That is, we don't have a big old pod castle in which we live. I'm joined by Geek Queen Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I feel like Adam Driver does a little bit of driving in Ferrari. I just want to correct the statement there.
Yeah, it's Ferrari.
Not the
you expect
racing
him to
driver,
like,
you know.
Yeah, but you know, he leaves it to someone else, doesn't he? So, but if you do want to see Adam Driver driving, I can recommend Patterson.
Oh yeah, bus driving. I
yes.
love that film.
Yes, indeed.
That'd be a good Twixtmas film, actually, because it's just so meditative and
boring.
Nothing
is
happened.
The
no.
You're looking for.
I was interested. It was just like, okay. Just chilled, you know.
I'm glad someone was. We're also joined by our great big fucking nerd, James Dyer. Hello, James Dyer.
Hello, Christopher. I'm full of Toblerone and not in a sexy way. I mean, I ate the Toblerone.
Have you driven barefoot to Dundee, a la Alan Partridge?
No. No, I just picked one up from Sainsbury's.
All right,
one of the massive, like, whopping ones. Although, again, the shrinkflation is real, folks, because the pyramids of the Toblerone are significantly further spaced apart than previously. They did this once before where they really spaced them apart. Then they put them back, and now they've moved them apart a little bit.
Mm.
You can tell, because if like true professionals who refrigerate their Toblerones, this is a very, very exciting anecdote, slide their fingers between the peaks to snap them off so you can tell the difference.
You must. Yeah. One must never slide one's fingers between the peaks to snap them off.
True.
Oh, boy.
If I know one thing, it is that above all others. Anyway, Merry Christmas to you both. How was it?
I had a lovely time. I was up with my small niece and nephew, who are a lot of fun and who rule the roost with an iron fist. We watched Wonka. We went to see Wonka, which was wonderful. Although my nephew did come out and go, now can we watch a kids' movie? Which, you know, I thought was unfair, if I'm
right.
honest.
Outrageous. Absolutely outrageous.
He's very young. He's got time to learn.
Yes. But he enjoyed it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did enjoy it. Both of them complained at first because they're not really used to watching full-length non-animated films.
Yes.
But then they just sat there, like, just transfixed. So,
yeah,
it was good.
I feel this is the gateway drug to live-action Wonka. For me, little drinking game, got a number of Christmas presents that were Wonka related. I discovered there was quite a bit of Wonka merchandise and shelled out, frankly, far too much money on Wonka Converse.
Oh, I you know, once you said that, I looked them up and those are pretty sweet.
They are pretty sweet. They're for adults as well. But Wonka Converse, Wonka chocolate toothpaste, which is a thing. It's actual toothpaste made by High Smile. It's limited edition. It's ruinously expensive, just as the Oompa Loompa song is ruinously catchy. But it's that's gone down very, very well. Some Wonka Funko Pops.
Mm.
That's how my Christmas has been, I guess. Lots of Wonka-related stuff. Jimbo, what about you?
Well, I have rarely left the house in this slightly curious hinterland that we find ourselves in where time has no meaning, which is one of my favorite times in the year, the period between Christmas and New Year, when the whole world is basically dead and time stops. Yes, indeed. The perineum of the year.
The merineum.
I've been just doing stuff that I've been meaning to do and not got around to. So I have a huge list of stuff, like a massive list of stuff that I need to watch. So I did obviously what anyone would do and watched absolutely none of it and have been rewatching Banshee all day, every day, which is clearly ridiculous and beyond parody, but here we are.
Oh boy.
I'm near the end of season
man.
3.
How many seasons did they make?
There are four.
Five?
I plan to finish
four.
Before we come
okay.
back.
All right. Okay. Oh, so boy. James goes quiet for a while. It's probably because he's watching a Banshee episode during this
recording.
During
the podcast, yeah.
Yeah. which is obviously...
He usually does, to be fair.
Usually does. I haven't been watching a great deal either because I always have the best laid plans of Mice and Men around this time of year, you know, to watch loads of stuff and catch up on things that I have missed. And apart from a couple of trips to the cinema to see some films for review for this week... I haven't really seen much because I always forget that this is a time of great sport on TV. So the darts is on at the moment, the World Darts Championship, and I always end up watching that. In fact, I'm missing it right now to do this, and I'm furious with you both. And then there's football as well, so loads of football on. But I have been watching a couple of things. So I started watching the Peter Ustinov Death on the Nile the other day, which actually has a scene where they went and shot, as far as I can tell, on the Great Pyramids themselves, on the Great Pyramid of Giza, which is incredible, given that when Kenneth Branagh did his remake / version of Death on the Nile, they went to a CG pyramid that is amongst some of the worst CG I've ever seen in my entire life. And it's like, it's right there. It's right there. Peter Ustinov. Well, not Peter Ustinov.
I'm pretty sure you're not allowed to even take pictures of it now, are you?
Yeah. So.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that, but I think you're definitely not allowed to climb on it.
Yes. They're quite restrictive in a way that they used to be. They were slightly more cavalier in the past.
I looked it up because you have Simon McCorkindale and Lewis Childs and Mia Farrow just kind of climbing up this thing. And I was like, either that's an amazing set or they have recreated it somewhere, but it looks a lot like it. And I looked it up and they actually did. They shot a lot in Egypt and they shot a lot on location and they had full permission to do so. And it's absolutely incredible. I've been watching that and I've also been watching a lot of What If.
I haven't started that yet because I haven't even caught up entirely with Reacher, although I'm having a lovely time in season two. And has he gotten even bigger? Anyway,
yes.
He has, right? Yes. Like he's
has,
wider.
Yeah. He no longer
I feel
fits
like he's
through
wider.
Doors.
He doesn't, he has to go sideways. Mm. It's a whole thing. So I watched that. I watched the Doctor Who Christmas special. I watched the Ghost Christmas special.
I haven't seen it yet.
No spoilers here, but it's wonderful. And just had a lovely time, watching a lot of animated movies. And one that I know you watched as well, Chris, the animated Grinch was on again this Christmas.
I've been watching that in fits and starts, and Chicken Run Dawn of the Nugget is the film of choice here at the moment that is on a daily basis at the moment. But I would say that the film that I have stumbled upon, whose existence, frankly, I didn't even know of until just the other day, is Leo. Now, have you guys heard of Leo?
I have heard of
only
it,
from
yes.
You.
But no, I'd heard of it previously. Right. I can't even remember why.
I think we covered the trailer when it came out, but then the film itself sort of sneaked out.
I didn't even know this film existed, let alone had been on Netflix since November. So Leo is an animated movie co-written by and starring Adam Sandler, but also co-written and directed by Robert Smigel, who is the comic genius behind Triumph the Insult Comic Dog and various things like that. And he and Sandler have worked together for a while now. They co-wrote with Judd Apatow, You Don't Mess with the Sohan, years and years ago. And Leo is his animated story about this very, very old lizard, a school pet voiced by Adam Sandler, who lives in a terrarium in school alongside his best friend, Squirtle, played by Bill Burr. And Leo can talk. They could both talk. They could both talk like actual human beings. Now, this is something that they're light they have kept under the bushel. But then one day they start being taken home to spend time with individual pupils and the gift is slowly revealed. And it's really good. It's really fucking good. It's funny. It's heartwarming. It's got this lovely acerbic quality to it as well. It's for kids, but there's also lots of stuff in there for grown-ups also. It's got some good songs in it as well, the songs that are also written by Robert Smigel. And it's really, really good. I cannot recommend it enough. And it came out in November. We completely missed it when it came out. I didn't even know about it until we were flicking through kids' stuff on Netflix. I was like, what the hell is this Leo thing? And then I clicked on it and was like, hang on, this is an Adam Sandler movie. But honestly, I know I'm a much bigger fan of Adam Sandler than you guys are, but give it a whirl. You may like it. It's a good one, Leo.
Cool.
And I will say, I'm only a few episodes into season two of What If so far, but it is really, really good. And episode three in particular, What If Happy Hogan Saved Christmas? You both will love it because it is a wonderful diehard riff.
Huh. Yes, I've heard about this one.
It's so good. So good. All right. Shall we have a question?
Please.
Jay Cox Ryder asks, what are your film-based New Year's resolutions?
Film-based? Okay. Well, I finally caved to, I guess, modern tradition and set up a Letterboxd so that I can keep track of the shit that I watch next year. But crucially, Helen, this is not for bragging rights because it is entirely private. It is for my own failing memory so that when we get to the end of next year and I have to go back through the things to do my best shows and best films of the year list, I won't have to go through, jump through quite as many hoops as I did this year trying to work out what on earth I'd seen. So I'm going to keep track of all of the shows I watched for Pilot, and which will take less time, the films I watched for this podcast, and I'm going to put them all in that. And yeah, it's going to help. It's organization. I'm very excited.
I mean, look, nothing against people who use Letterboxd. I know people who use it and love it and get something out of it. And I enjoy all of the weirdly specific lists that people make. I think those are very fun and clever. I cannot keep track of another thing in my life. I can't do it. I have step counters and, you know, everything. I refuse. No. I've got Duolingo chasing me already. I'm not going to sign up to something else.
It doesn't do like a, these are the minimum films you must watch this week.
No, I'm sure it doesn't, but I can't. No, I just refuse. With respect, love to you all. No.
Fair. I mean, I've been resisting it thus far.
Yeah. I have no film-based New Year's resolutions. I want to see films. It's already my job. I don't feel like I need to introduce another metric, you know. I'm just going to keep watching films.
That seems fair.
Yeah, I don't have any New Year's resolutions. I don't make them because I know I will not keep them and I will break them instantly. And a couple of years ago, I made the foolish mistake of like even going on Twitter and going, by the end of the year, I will have made a short film. Like I've written short film scripts. And I didn't. So I'm not going to do something bold. I'm not going to proclaim that I'm going to be directing Avengers 6 by the end of the year. Although, they could do a lot worse. Okay, let's move on. Here's one from 20th Century Mark. All four Hollywood Chrises did voice acting for animation this year. Rank their performances best to worst.
Oof.
Oh,
did they?
Well, did they?
Okay,
I mean,
Pine,
of course they
Pine
did.
And Wish. Pine and Wish, which
Pine
I saw again
Wish.
Recently.
Okay,
Pratt
yes.
Pratt goes last, surely, just by default for Mario.
Why?
No, not personally personal against Chris Pratt, but that Mario movie was an abomination against gods and men, so, you know. I think we can all agree the voice of Mario should have been Adam Driver. We'll get onto that a little bit later in the show.
So with Chris Evans, are we talking Lucas Lee in Scott Pilgrim Takes Off? Because
we
that is going to be number
Lucas
one.
Lee.
If
yes.
so, that's number one.
Yes, and Hemsworth is. I presume he's talking about What If.
I guess so, he's talking. Is he talking What If? Yeah, I guess
else?
He must be talking What If.
Yeah. All right. So you haven't seen What If, but Hemsworth is good. He's in a number of episodes.
But he's playing Thor, right? So I kind of know what that sounds like. I feel like I can still have something of an opinion about that.
But Evans is playing Lucas Lee, so we
but
know
Evans
what that
is
sounds
playing
like.
Lucas, I know. So that's number one.
Why is that number one?
Because Lucas Lee
Thor,
is hilarious.
Thor is better than Lucas Lee.
I mean, Lucas Lee is worse than Thor, yes, exactly. But he's meant to be, so I would say that's a success. So maybe he's better
so
at being bad
right
than Thor is at being good, you know?
Okay, I'm really confused about what's happening. I think this is really tricky. This is really tricky because as much as I loathe the Super Mario Brothers movie, I don't think that Pratt was that bad in it. I mean, it's a choice to cast him in that role, and he then made another choice to not try and sound anything like Mario does in the games.
Should that be applauded?
But I think he at least, you know, he doesn't just rock up and go, hey, I'm Chris Pratt and I'm just doing a voice. He actually does an accent and he tries something and listen, he's Star-Lord, leave him alone. He's Andy Dwyer, leave him alone. Leave him alone. He's Burt Macklin, FBI. Leave the man alone for the love of God. So I'm going to I'm going to rank them all number one equally.
Oh boy. I think we should probably give Pine more credit than we're giving him. He was very good as Magnifico. He sang well.
He did
sing well.
I don't think the film's problems were necessarily on him, you know?
No.
So, like, I do think the film could have been stronger, but it, you know, it was fine.
I agree.
So, and also maybe he gets bonus points, as does Pine, for having done like a full performance, like a sort of feature length performance, rather than fairly small roles in animated TV shows.
Okay, all right, okay. In that case, all right, in that case, we have to go Pine, number one, because he sings as well. Mm-hmm. Right, Pine, number one.
Yep.
Then Pratt, because full length beats it's shrinkflation, James. Full length cameos.
No. Because also, Lucas Lee is not a cameo in Scott Pilgrim Takes Off.
Oh, come on.
Not a cameo,
he's
but
in it
not
a fair old bit.
All right, okay. They fuck you in the animation booth. I'm going to go Pine, number one, because he sings.
Sure.
Pine,
Evans, Hemsworth, Pratt.
Oh, I don't know if I can put Evans above Hemsworth. I don't know if I can.
I can. It's fine.
I'm also going to take into consideration... Okay. I'm going to take into consideration as well, as a tiebreaker, their live action performances from this year as well. So therefore, Pine, who is in Wish, he sings, plus he's in Dungeons and Dragons. Pine is number one.
He's number one,
then,
yeah.
Number two, I'm going to have to put Hemsworth, because Hemsworth was in Extraction 2.
Yeah.
Tyler Rake, MFers, and Evans, sadly, is making Lucas Lee-like choices in his live-action career at the moment.
Well,
and
Pain
the one-two
Hustlers
punch of Ghosted and Pain Hustlers.
Oh, yeah.
No. Fair. No. And then bottom is Pratt. Did Pratt have a live-action one this year?
Guardians.
I don't remember. Oh, yeah. Oh,
oh God. All right. Pratt has leaped.
All right, fine.
Pratt has leaped over Evans. Okay, yeah, I'm going to put Evans at the bottom. Sorry.
Wow.
I'm sorry. But that's just my ranking. That's just my personal ranking. You guys can come up with a different order.
Whatever the opposite of your ranking is, I'll take that.
All right, so James has gone for Evans at number one, then Pratt, then Hemsworth, then Pine at the bottom.
Wow, you suck, James.
Hell's bells?
I'll go Pine number one. I really did like Guardians 3, and you know I don't say that lightly.
I know you don't.
Okay, fine. I'll have Pratt at number two, and then Evans, and then Hemsworth.
I don't know. There is a wayward Pine on your list, and I'm not happy about it.
Hey.
very good. You utter prat. All right. If you want to have your question read out on the Emperor podcast, you can get in touch with us via a number of methods, but it's really only Twitter, isn't it? I'm at Chris Hewitt. You can slide into my DMs. You can reply to any of my panicked shout outs, or you can reply to any of my tweets once you've stopped laughing, of course. And if we like the question, then we will save it and talk about it on a future show for sure. All right. Shall we have a guest?
Yes, let's.
It is just after Christmas, and we have two cracking Christmas gifts still under the tree to be unwrapped. One is in the shape of Michael Fassbender, and the other is in the shape of Adam Driver. Which one would you like?
Let's say Michael Fassbender to begin with.
Marley was dead to begin with. Michael Fassbender had come back to begin with. Michael Fassbender has been away, would you believe, as an actor for 4 years. The last time we saw him on our screens was as Magneto in X-Men Dark Phoenix. And we all wanted to take 4 years off after that movie, quite frankly, but only he did. But not intentionally, as he explained to me whenever I caught up with him in London just before Christmas. We were there to talk about his starring role as an irascible football coach in Taika Waititi's Next Goal Wins, which is a film inspired by the excellent documentary of the same name about the national football team of American Samoa, who were the worst football team in the world at that point. And then a Danish coach called Thomas Rongen was appointed to take over. That inspired Taika Waititi so much that he made a film about it and cast Michael Fassbender, somewhat against type because it is a comedy and Michael Fassbender's CV is littered with very, very, very serious films. But he has a funny side to him, as anyone who's heard a Michael Fassbender interview will know. And so I was delighted to catch up with him. It's been too long. We talked about Next Goal Wins. We talked about why he took 4 years off. And we talked about his incredible performance in David Fincher's The Killer, which is also a comedy of sorts. So here we go. 'Tis the season for Michael Fassbender being funny, as he is in this interview. Do please enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast for the first time in ages by Michael Fassbender, star of Next Goal Wins, and recently, of course, The Killer. How are you, sir?
I'm great.
Good. Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Long time no see. Where have you been? What have you been up to? What's been going on?
What have I been up to?
You talk for the next 20 minutes. I'll just leave the room.
Yeah, exactly. What have I been up to? It's not that exciting, actually. Well, it is, actually. I was racing for Porsche for the last 5 years and became a dad.
Yeah.
And exciting. Those two things really kind of took up all of my time to try and do them well.
That's the tricky part, isn't it?
That is the tricky part. That is definitely the tricky part.
Are they in any way comparable to the act of driving at high speed?
Yeah, stay in between the white lines at all times. I think the driving, I was going to say, is easier. But I mean, I can't say that because I haven't really made a success of it. Not to say, we'll find out with my son whether I made a success of it in some years. It's great. Love it. Love them both. So I just had the time to do that.
Yeah.
I knew I was going to, you know, take a break 2018. I'd sort of been doing a run of work. And actually, I stopped 2017, but promotion was 2018 because I did the Ferrari Challenge in 2017.
Okay.
And then... started the adventure with Porsche. And the thing is, I just couldn't do any work because, well, I could, but basically the racing season was from beginning of April to the end of October.
Yeah.
So I can't get insured, you know, to do anything in that time period.
Yeah.
So the only window I really had was end of October through to end of March.
Uh-huh.
And this happened to fall in that territory, as did The Killer, actually.
Oh, right. Okay. Because it wasn't an intentional break. If you look at your CV, there's a big four-year gap between Dark Phoenix and these two movies. But obviously this filmed a couple of years ago.
Well, we've shot this in 2019.
Yeah.
And then I also shot Kung Fury 2 in 2019. So I did these two films, actually, kind of Kung Fury and then went straight on to this. Kung Fury was one of those films that we could fit in the four-week gap that I was racing in between races.
Mm.
And then I did this at the end of the season. And then 2021, end of 2021, we did The Killer.
Yeah. Because obviously these two films have come out within a few weeks of each other. And they strike me as a study in contrasts.
Yes.
In terms of directors, for
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
You know, Mr. Fincher is renowned for being meticulous.
Absolutely.
It's a meticulous film about a meticulous man, and in some ways maybe a self-portrait. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
That's not for us to say.
Definitely not.
Taika is a little bit more loosey-goosey, I would say, with his approach. That's certainly my experience and my reading of the situation from your point of view.
Well, it's not far off. So, like, you know, I would say that Taika, it's a lot of sort of improvisational stuff, certainly in the scenes that I was doing. Chaos isn't the right word, but it is a sense of elasticity within the scenes. So we're getting pulled in lots of different directions. We're trying lots of different things out and discovering on the moment. Not a great deal of love of, I suppose, repetition of things, but I'm not sure if that's fair. But then the energy that he brings is intense, like, is incredible to witness, like, phenomenal. He's a phenomenon, like, that creative energy, that sort of fun energy, the love of what he's doing. It's like, you know, it's intoxicating. It's so infectious. And you can see that, you know, throughout the set when you're working together. We shot it in 25 days, so short shoot. You know, David is somebody who's very precise. You know, so it's like through repetition, you get distillation. So you distill something until you find where it's supposed to be at through the repetition of it at times.
Yeah.
But certainly everything is very precise. For whatever's in the frame, you know, is he's looking at everything in the frame. And they're totally different. And I love that, you know, I'm so lucky to be able to sort of experience that with Taika and here, and then go over onto The Killer and experience that with David. It's somewhat, it's fantastic because I can just sort of watch and learn and experience.
How much of it with both of them is a known quantity? How much did the experience meet your expectations of what the experience would be like?
Pretty much both exactly as I would have thought. And that is a good thing. You know, that means I had a great time in both.
Yeah.
Because I imagined them both to have that style, which they did. And, you know, I would say the common ground between the two is generosity. You know, you're in on the sort of mix of what's going on. You know, everything's sort of like, if you come to the table, you know, ready to go to work, because it's the sort of same thing, you know, with Taika, you know, you're surrendering to a way of working. You know, the director is the boss. So you've got to jump on their vision of how things are going to be, you know, how the story's going to be told, how they're the real artist, you know. And we're kind of like, let's say if they're the architect building a house, I'm coming in doing the stairs or something, you know.
Right.
So it's like you surrender to that, and then everything is, you know, is open and generous. The same thing with Fincher, super generous, you know. And again, both of them have a great equality on set in terms of how they speak to the actors, to how they speak to the camera department, hair and makeup, or whoever. Mm. It's the same dialogue for everyone. It's great, great. Two great experiences and two very different ones.
Let's zoom in a bit more on Next Goal Wins.
Yeah.
Although, as I was watching it, I did think that you could have applied...
Inner
monologue.
You could have done better, honestly.
You could have applied the inner monologue of the killer to Thomas Rongen.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, like, you know, anticipate, don't improvise, you know, don't let empathy in. Because this is a guy who is, you know, in another life, he could have, you know.
Totally.
He could have, you know, I'm not going to say it, but he could have killed a lot of people.
Well, I think that is probably the inner monologue of
most of
Thomas.
Coaches.
It's like, of Thomas Rongen. It's like, stick to the plan. Don't improvise. But he's all about improvising. I mean, I think the thing with Thomas Rongen, you know, again, you know, there is the real Thomas Rongen. So he's there in the sort of documentary. But this Thomas Rongen is just something that we started developing, you know, on set, really, you know. And we realized this is not the same guy in the documentary. To serve our story, we sort of made, you know, this Thomas Rongen's a lot more cantankerous. He's a lot more broken. You know, you can't imagine anybody really wanting to spend time with this guy when he arrives on the island. And for, you know, the first part of being on the island, he's definitely somebody who's in pain. And so, you know, there's definitely a healing process that happens to him here. But I like that idea of the inner monologue from the killer inside his head. That's funny.
I want to do it. Someone else who's better at editing than me will knock that together at some point. It will happen. It will happen. But that's fascinating to me that you and Taika began to develop that on the go, because obviously you've played real life people before, but this is a situation where the real life guy is alive. Was he involved at all, or was it very much?
No, he wasn't, you know, and that was like, there was one time, I think, where he was, you know, they were to talk about him visiting, and I was like, oh my God, you know, he's going to be horrified by, you know, this sort of character that I'm presenting. Maybe it's not the best idea. So I'm kind of still like a bit nervous to meet him in real life. But I'm sending it out there now that this is not the real Thomas Rongen. So, you know, it started when we were on the phone, actually, Taika and I, and I was like, oh, what about this Dutch accent? And he was like, I don't think you should do it. He was like, people aren't going to understand what you're doing anyway. They think it's like some, you know, weird German accent you're trying to do or something. So, and I was like, well, that was a bit of a relief, because I knew that if we were improvising and going in lots of different directions on the day, that would be tricky to maintain an accent and do that. And it's a pretty tricky accent too, the Dutch accent, I found anyway. And then, as we sort of started filming it day by day, this character just started sort of developing in a certain direction. And like I say, more obviously, you know, there is the common sort of link between the real Thomas Rongen and what happened with his daughter. But, you know, that is sort of at the crux of this story. For me, anyway, everything that I sort of, you know, found within the character stems from that moment in his life. And then it was just sort of expanding on that.
And that sort of thing is kind of where we would normally expect to see you as an actor, the emotional turmoil of the character. But this is a comedy, you know, at its very heart. Were you looking for a comedy?
I mean, I wasn't looking for a comedy. I'm never really looking for anything.
You don't necessarily say, get me that, or I'd like to do this.
No, I've never gone like, it's, my time to do the Dane. it's like, it's just really what comes about. And that's always been a bit like that for me. It's just what sort of, what arrives on the table. And that's just exactly what happened here. I like to do comedy if it's the right ingredients and it feels like the right place to do it, for sure. I've always been a fan of comedy and,
I've laughed in the past.
Yeah, yeah. And I like joking around. So this seemed like a good fit.
Yeah. Was part of the appeal also the fact that it's about football. Notoriously hard to get right on the big screen, but...
No. I'm not really a big football fan.
Yeah.
I mean, I watch, the odd game. I am a Liverpool fan. I've already done, an interview with Liverpool and pretended that I was a huge fan. I've always been Liverpool. I watch games. I always watch the World Cup. I watch the European Cup. I watch, certain big league games. But I'm not one of those guys that needs to sit and every weekend or catch every game, Yeah. It's I like motorsport and that's kind of my thing. It was no appeal for me.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because you rocked up. I'm very jealous of you about this, Michael. You rocked up at Anfield for the Barcelona game.
For the first time ever at Anfield.
Honestly, people like you make me sick. I desperately get tickets for that game. And then you just waltz in, Fassbender, and you just take the best seat in the house and end up on the Anfield wrap afterwards. So
I know, which was amazing. Those guys wanted me to come on the bus. was the final in Istanbul again?
No, it was in Madrid, Spain.
Yeah. I unfortunately couldn't because I had some other work engagement. But it was an amazing night. It was an amazing experience, and I have to say, I do draw a lot of inspiration from this current Liverpool team.
Yeah.
Under Klopp's management, I think he's incredible.
He is. Yeah. That's wild. So that's the first time you were at Anfield?
Yeah. And my friend was like, should we go to the game? I mean, it's like, it's impossible. Should we still make the trip up? And I was like, we got to go. I mean, you got to go. It's like that scene out of Goodfellas. You got to go. You got to go. You got to go. So I was like, we got to go. So we went up there and, just as soon as we got into the stadium, it was like, yeah, amazing. The vibe, the sort of atmosphere, the fans, the Liverpool fans. Just overwhelming, breathtaking, exhilarating. Like literally the hairs are standing on the back of my neck. This was before the game even started. So you can imagine when it was going one goal, second goal, third goal, fourth goal. I mean, it was wild.
I have a theory that most people in the stadium didn't actually see the final goal. Did you witness it with your own eyes or did you just hear the noise?
What was the last goal? Was it, the corner?
The pretend corner.
I did see it. Yeah.
You saw it?
Yeah.
Look me in the eye and tell me that.
I did, because I remember that was like, I have a video of it actually on my phone.
What?
Yeah. Well, of our reactions after it. But I do remember the pretend, it was
Trent Alexander-Arnold,
pretending to run back out, go back and kick it in and Origi.
Yeah. All right, okay, there you go.
Definitely saw it.
Done. But yes, back to the film, and in terms of shooting, can you remember it, first of all, because it was so long ago?
It's hazy. For a number of reasons. No, literally, it's like, I do tend to have a very sort of goldfish memory. Even when I try and recall lines that I've spent so many times learning, because I do spend a lot of times with the text and whatever I'm doing. This, like I said, was a lot looser in terms of how we approached it. But whenever I leave a set, it sort of evaporates for me.
Really?
So a lot of the times in these interviews, I'm just making stuff up.
Okay.
Kaimana just left here. I have no idea who that person is. I just did.
Have we met before?
We
spent 6 months making
it. No, I'm only messing. I do remember, but it was 4 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Just kind of wild.
It's interesting that you quoted Goodfellas there in terms of going up to Anfield, because Thomas Rongen in the movie drops so many movie references.
Oh, does he?
He's a bit of a cinephile. Have you seen this movie, Michael?
Yes, Next Goal Wins. So,
it's good. You're in it.
What does he say?
He's quoting, obviously there's the Inches scene where he's quoting that, but he quotes Liam Neeson when he first arrives in American Samoa.
Oh, me, you mean? Yeah. I thought you meant the guy, the real Thomas Rongan.
No, this is confusing. You play Thomas Rongan in the film Next Cold Winter.
Because I was thinking, wow, we did it in the film too. I was like, that was good. I missed that in the documentary. Yeah, we do it in the film. Yeah.
Yeah. Did I come from you or you're a big
That
film
was Taika.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That I did ask him to play the music of as I'm arriving for the first time in American Samoa. I'm like, you know, carrying the busted wheelie suitcase, and that I'm walking to the theme music of the streets of San Francisco. It just makes me feel good.
The streets of San Francisco.
A Quinn Martin production. Starring
Carl Malden.
Also starring
Michael Douglas.
Leaning on the top of that beautiful green Porsche.
See, now again, someone who's good at editing can do a Streets of San Francisco opening credit sequence.
Yeah, yeah.
Guest starring Michael Fassbender.
I'm surprised they haven't done a remake of that.
They should do a remake of that. Is this what you're... putting your oar in the water, so to speak. I would love that. I love that show. So,
yeah. So did I.
One of the greatest theme tunes of all time.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Let's talk about The Killer as well. When did The Killer come your way? Seemed when you were 100 miles an hour, the phone rings.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, give me a second. I was like, yes. it came my way again. Guessing, like forget.
Just make
like,
it up.
Yeah, exactly. Just make it up.
Nobody knows.
August, I'm going to say August 21. Okay. Maybe actually earlier in the summer of the summer of 21. No, my agent told me it was 2020. Anyway, it just shows you how bad my memory is.
It's all good. Yeah.
So anyway, that you know, it's just started talking to David, talking about it, and then you know, then it was like I told him, you know, I had the racing season. He was like, okay, we'll wait. I was like, amazing. And you know, the thing is, for me with The Killer, I was talking to my partner at DMC, you know, the production company we have, and I was like, I'd seen Les Samurai probably only for the first time like 6 years ago.
Okay.
And I was like, God, I was like, this film's amazing. You know, I was like, why are there no films like this? You know, like Point Blank, Les Samurai, something that's really, you know, boiled down, raw, mean, lean sort of film. And then Fincher called me up about this and I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. I mean, he's the perfect director at the helm of something like this. And just felt like fingers crossed that it wasn't, you know, it was actually going to happen. You know, it was just so felt so lucky and grateful. And then, you know, the experience shooting it was an absolute joy. You know, obviously high standards.
Yeah.
You know, but like I say, for everyone the same, and he sets the high standards for himself more than anyone. You know.
I mean, the lots of takes things, is that apocryphal or is it very much that he will keep going until he gets what he needs?
That's right. And, you know, it's like, that's the way it is. You know, it's like you kind of, you know what you're sort of getting into. There's no like, you know, secret or mystery around it. You know, this is it. You know, and I was sort of somebody, you know, like my favorite takes take the first take. But it, again, it's like, this is the process. This is his process. He's in charge. The director is... It's all down to the director, whether the film is going to, you know, whether you're going to sing and the film's going to sing, everything's going to come together. So it's like you have to, you know, just sort of open yourself up and go for it.
I think it's extraordinary. Yes, The Samurai, but also it reminded me a lot of, you know, the sort of 70s revenge thrillers that you would have found at
like
Joe Don Baker
like Point Blank, yeah.
Like Point
yeah.
Blank or, yeah, yeah. or Walter Matthau would have shown up
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
It's not
and there's
quite...
a bit of Charles Bronson in there, you know, it's like...
Absolutely.
In fact, I think that was like a note that Fincher gave me. He was like, do your best Bronson in this part. I was like, okay, got it, like it.
That's interesting because it's a brilliant exercise in doing everything whilst doing nothing. And micro expressions and body language, and that must have been one hell of a thing for you to do.
Well, actually, you know, it came sort of pretty early on when we started doing the wardrobe fitting, you know, when we started trying, again, super like inclusive and always like, and we put on the bucket hat and, you know, Les Samurai, you know, Alain Delon looks fantastic. He's cool. He's chic. And we were like, no, this guy's a little odd. You know, we wanted it to be not cool.
Yeah.
So like everything that it was doing then in terms of like the physicality of the character, his process, everything for me, it's like, this is not going to be cool. Mm. You know, this is going to be like an outsider. This person is like, I always thought, well, this person doesn't have any friends. You know, he's socially sort of inept. He's just got his girlfriend, you know, and the life he's created in the Dominican Republic. But outside of that, he's socially inept. It's not, you know, and I didn't want him to be cool at all. And then I was like, don't like, just do everything simply. And then afterwards I was like, shit, I should have jazzed it up a little bit, maybe. Jazz.
Well, they can do incredible things with VFX these days. Like, he's got jazz hands all the way through.
I hope that's sort of the right thing. And it was. It was just like the pure sort of action of what he was doing, you know.
I've got to ask about the Smiths.
Yeah.
Because this guy, the killer, loves the Smiths. I mean, I don't think anyone has ever loved the Smiths more than this guy.
The hit playlist. It was like, for sure, that was the Paris playlist, you know. Actually, it was the whole playlist of the whole movie, of course. You know, that's all David, you know. He was like, what would, if a sort of assassin had a playlist, what would that playlist be? You know, something that can help lower their heartbeat. And he was like, well, it's sort of the humor of the Smiths and the sort of somberness, that you know, the darkness, the irony of it,
yeah,
seemed like a perfect playlist for this guy.
Were you listening to the Smiths on set?
No.
Okay.
I don't think David plays music on set. No.
Okay.
Not like Quentin. Quentin plays music in between setups. Imagine. I had like the iPod Nano or whatever that's called. I did have that, but there was a different playlist that was on.
Right.
I think it had some really kind of, like, kind of weird jazz. Jazz again. No wonder I was thinking about jazzing it up. It was on the iPad. It's like, jazz.
Well, by nice. Your own admission, you make stuff up. So I have no idea if that's true or not, or if anything you said is true at all. But it's been fun nevertheless. Michael Fassbender, always a pleasure, man.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, brother.
Thank you so much. Cheers, man. Thank you.
Okay, that was Michael Fassbender. We will be talking about Next Goal Wins later on in the show. As it is, it's time for the movie news section. And incredibly, there is some movie news. Not a lot, but there is some movie news. We should maybe start with the news that Scream 7, having lost its leading ladies in the shape of Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega for very different reasons over the last few weeks, has now lost its director. Christopher Landon, who is the director of films like Happy Death Day, Happy Death Day to You, Freaky, and We Have a Ghost, has left the project.
Mm. Yeah, no director, no stars, which is not an ideal place for a film to be.
It does feel very much like they're going to have to start over again with this. I don't see, you know, if there was a plan, then that plan would seem to be out the window, surely. So I think the best thing to do might be to just clean slate it with these characters and find a new place to go.
Yeah. They'll let it lie fallow for a while until it cools down a bit. And then if they see, you know, Benjamins at the end of it, then they'll dust it off again. Much as it wounds me, I don't think, creative expression has a great deal to do with it. It's entirely a financial one.
All right. So whenever I asked people for questions for this week's podcast, I said that there wasn't a lot of movie news to talk about, although I said James could probably do a tight 20 on The Abyss's 4K physical release apparently being cancelled in the UK. Now, Jimbo, what is this? What's happening?
So my understanding of this, obviously, we were due a number of things next year. We were due the 4K of Aliens, which is June. The 4K release of Aliens, which is the most exciting home entertainment release next year. We were finally getting not just an HD, but a 4K edition of The Abyss, which has been hitherto only on DVD, I believe, in the UK so far. That has been on streaming, technically, if you don't want physical media. And we were getting True Lies as well. So some of those will be arriving next year. We're still getting Aliens, thank God, in March, but we will not my understanding is, be getting The Abyss anymore due to a slight, shall we say, misunderstanding with the BBFC, who took issue with the scene. I don't know how well you know the film, but when they, you know, obviously they have this thing where they breathe this kind of liquid oxygen pink goo substance. And there is a point where, to show that it works, they make a rat breathe the pink goo and they submerge this rat in essentially slime. And yeah, the rat seems fine. I'm sure it didn't really enjoy it.
The rat emerges unscathed, yes.
It does emerge unscathed. However, the BBFC took a very dim view of this kind of ratastrophe. And they basically said, this will not stand. We will not have it. You're going to have to cut it. And Disney went, sure, absolutely. We will cut that scene. And Cameron said, like fuck you will. And therefore...
These are direct quotes.
Direct quote from James Cameron. Direct quotes. Like fuck you will. The rat stays or I'm out. And so, yeah. So The Abyss is not getting its 4K disc release now next year because of the rat.
I don't, like, I'm going to have to go back and watch my DVD, but like, I don't ever remember watching the film without that scene. Like, I feel like it's on my DVD.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah. Because I've got the film and it has that in it. So I don't know why they've suddenly become quite rat averse or pro rat, maybe.
Are they also now trying to cut The Godfather?
Yeah, possibly.
Did they think the horse was killed?
Well, I think, you know, maybe someone said they had to do something pro rata and they just took it literally.
Oh, boy.
Is it going to be still on Disney Plus, do you know?
You ask a good question, because it presumably, because they don't, streaming doesn't need a BBFC rating, does it? So I'm not sure that it does. I don't entirely know, but I'm assuming it may well be.
This is something that's being reported at the moment, but we don't know everything about it. It has to be said, this feels like a massive overreaction on the part of the BBFC, because the rat... I've been reading about this morning. The rat was perfectly fine. And so they say anyway, like, you know, they went, this rat's totally fine. It's like, it looks like another rat. And meanwhile, the actual rat is over there in a bucket. But that's obviously not what happened. But the rat was totally, totally fine. And apparently they did breathe liquid, and that, you know, Cameron, being the big brained boffin that he is, looked into ways for things to breathe liquid. It's what we all do before we're born, right? So, you know, apparently he pulled it off. And I don't really know why they want to cut it, to be honest. It seems overly officious.
But then they've often taken a very strange view on things. I remember the nunchucks in Enter the Dragon, and in fact in Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles back in the day as well.
Yes. And in, was it the Brady Bunch, a very Brady sequel?
That's
was
right, one of the Brady Bunch in that as well. There was a headbutt removed from Attack of the Clones as well. Like when Django headbutts Obi-Wan Kenobi, that is cut from the UK version of that film.
Yeah, but I mean, that was kind of then. And the BBFC has, I think it's fair to say, been doing a much better job since and a much more kind of reasonable job since. So it's weird that this would kind of blow up. I know that, you know, animal cruelty is a very hot button topic for British people generally, but this is a, 35-year-old film? A scene that has been seen on every previous incarnation of the film, I think. So I just don't understand why it's suddenly
and obviously,
a problem.
35 years, the rat is now dead and could not sue even if it wanted to. So, you know, we're fine.
Because it has no standing, because it's a rat, James.
Well, a dead rat especially, so even less standing.
Wow.
And the rat never complained at the time, because he knows if you ratten your friends,
oh boy,
Kaiser Soze will get you.
That's true. It also had a mouth, sort of lung full of liquid, so it couldn't have done.
Oh.
Do you think this decision was made by a rat sitting on top of a censor's head under a giant hat,
yes,
pulling their hair and trying to manipulate
that's exactly
them
how
into
it
not
done.
Releasing it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think that might be what happened.
I can't tell you how excited I am about this Aliens release. I really am just so desperate to see it. And I'm waiting till March.
It's The Abyss. The Abyss is the one I'm massively excited about, because I love Aliens. I've seen it a lot. But The Abyss is not the blind spot of my Cameron filmography, because I've seen it.
Yeah.
But I really, really, really want to revisit it.
And you've seen
it,
this version, right? The extended version.
I don't think I have.
Because it's
significantly
better than the theatrical cut. Like, it has a proper ending with finished effects. It's a much better film in this one. Not a perfect film by any stretch, but a much better film.
Maybe they'll do the same for Ant-Man and the Wasp: Quantumania one of these days. And actually, the finished effects cut would be lovely. Even better than the original. Okay. Wonka has not made the shortlist for Best Original Song at next year's Oscars, which I have to say surprised, disappointed, and then infuriated me because, as you know, I'm a huge fan of Neil Hannon, and I think his songs in that, for that movie, are incredibly catchy and just really, really great traditional old-style musical songs. The reason I know this is because they announced this week the shortlist for a couple of Oscar categories. And Best Original Song, which, as long-time listeners to this podcast will know, is the category that I think has made the most number of egregious errors over the years, songs being completely overlooked, the wrong song winning, the wrong song losing, etc., etc., etc. Its track record is frankly shocking. The shortlist of 15 songs was announced this week. Absent from it was anything from Wonka and also anything from Wish, which I thought was interesting.
Wish denied.
But it's very unusual for the Disney film not to be shortlisted. You will be glad to know, though, in terms of like tradition being upheld, that there's a Diane Warren song because I think it's her 15th possible nomination.
Yeah.
So that's at least keeping up with tradition somehow. Flora and Son is there, which I hope you're happy about. That sounded
I'm
really
happy,
aggressive.
But
you know, I hope you're happy about. No, I'm. You know, it's good. It's a good film.
They're good songs. They're good songs. But yeah, I don't see why they got nominated and Wonka didn't. I think. Because I've been tracking this because I felt sure that Wonka would get nominated, and I think they put the wrong song forward. They put the song "A World of Your Own" from Wonka, which is the song that he sings. It's a great song.
Lovely song.
But it's maybe a little bit more traditional than some of the other songs from that musical, and perhaps didn't quite stick in the memory as much as, say, something like "For a Moment" or the opening song "A Half Full of Dreams." Or even Sweet Tooth, which is the big earworm for me, the bad guy song from Wonka. Anyway, listen, I've been banging on about Wonka for a long, long time, and I will continue to do so over the coming weeks, but I was just intrigued by its omission. There are 15 songs on the list. There's It Never Went Away from American Symphony. There's Dear Alien, Who Art in Heaven from Asteroid City, which is co-written by Jarvis Cocker and Wes Anderson, and Richard Hawley, of course. There's Dance the Night from Barbie. There's
Good
I'm
song.
Just Ken.
Great song.
There's What Was I Made For by Billie Eilish, which will win.
I think that's going to win, yeah.
That's going to win, yeah. And will, you know, be good because she won for the Bond song and probably didn't deserve it for that, but will deserve it for this. There's two songs from The Color Purple, that new tradition of, quick, we're making a movie out of this. Let's put some new songs in it so we qualify for this category.
Very old tradition at this point. It's been going on for decades.
That's true. That is true. Keep It Moving from The Color Purple. Superpower from The Color Purple. The Fire Inside by Diane Warren from Flamin' Hot. Two songs from Flora and Son, High Life and Meet in the Middle. Can't Catch Me Now from The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. Wazazi, which is from Killers of the Flower Moon. Quiet Eyes from Past Lives. A Road to Freedom from Rustin. And Am I Dreaming from Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Interesting, no Little Mermaid either, because there was a new song for Little
new
Mermaid,
song for
wasn't
that, it? Yeah, it's a list. I was genuinely kind of hoping for Peaches. I thought that would have been funny, even though I didn't love the film, but I thought that would be a fun nominee for Best Song. It really is the worst category. And I think there is a little bit of sometimes being impressed by stardom on it, you know, oh, a star made a song for this film, let's nominate that, which isn't necessarily the way it should ideally work, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's been worse lists, I guess, and I do feel like a lot of them are going to be filling time before What Was I Made For wins, so, you know, maybe it's maybe that's why people didn't put up their top songs.
True, and this is obviously not the way they should think about this category, but if they're thinking about how this is going to play televisually on the night, on the broadcast, then don't you want your biggest names performing on the night? So don't you want Timmy Two Meats on that stage singing a song?
Yeah, look, I want the cast of Theatre Camp singing Camp Isn't Home. That's
also
what I
didn't
want.
Get nominated.
Also didn't get nominated. Also isn't shortlisted. So look, it's already, all I can hope for at this point is that one of the Barbie songs, and by one of the Barbie songs, I mean either What Was I Made For or I'm Just Ken, because Dua Lipa, I love that song, but no, I don't want it to win. So I want one of those two to win. That's my Oscar wish.
Jimbo, do you have any strong Any feelings in this?
I feel very strongly that had Dune Part 2 come out year, then Gurney Halleck on the Balisette would 100% have swept the board. That is 100% a scene that appears in Dune Part 2.
We've still got that for next year.
We do. We do.
Fear is the Mind Killer 12-inch remix.
And the Oscars will undoubtedly overlook it then too.
Yeah.
We have some sad news to finish off with. Over the Christmas period, we lost Lee Sun-kyun, who was a South Korean actor who was most memorable in Parasite, the brilliant Parasite. He was the father of the well-to-do family in that, if you remember. He was found dead last week in Seoul at the age of just 48. Very, very sad indeed. And we also lost this week, at the age of 82, the great British writer-director David Leland, the writer of things like Mona Lisa, which is a terrific movie if you haven't seen it, Bob Hoskins and Michael Caine and Kathy Tyson. And he was a director of films like Wish You Were Here and The Big Man. And Liam Neeson was one of those who paid him a very, very heartfelt tribute after the news broke of his passing. Pierce Brosnan was also someone who paid tribute to him. David Leland apparently gave him his big break on the stage in a Tennessee Williams play. And he was a tremendous director of actors. Just check out Emily Lloyd's performance in Wish You Were Here for evidence of that. That's probably his best film, but he had a very, very solid CV indeed. David Leland, who passed away this week at the age of 82. All right, shall we have Adam Driver? He is, of course, one of the biggest stars in Hollywood, and tremendous actor and a wonderful guest host on Saturday Night Live. If you've ever seen him on that show, he's got this kind of deranged personality and brilliant comic timing. So check out a bunch of his sketches. Very, very good indeed. But anyway, he is the star this week of Michael Mann's Ferrari, which is a passion project that Michael Mann has been trying to make for a long, long, long time. And Adam Driver plays Enzo Ferrari, who is, yes, Lat Ferrari, the man behind those amazing cars. And it tells the tale of a particular period in his life where he was undergoing marital strife, shall we say. His wife in this is played brilliantly by Penelope Cruz. And it also has some intrigue burning on the racetrack as well. Now, we sent along Alex Godfrey to have a natter with Adam Driver when the latter came to London last month, I believe it was. And they had a very, very good time indeed. And I hope you will too. Here we go. Do please enjoy.
Great to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Let me just for those who don't know, this Ferrari, which I've seen twice.
Oh.
Absolutely loved it. It is engrossing and enthralling exciting and heart-stopping stuff. And let me just tell people that I would call it a character study rather than a biopic. Mm. It's not a biopic. It only takes place over, a few months, I think. Mm-hmm. In 57, Enzo Ferrari, the boss of the company, is having a pretty bad time. His son has recently died. His business is not looking good. He has an atrocious relationship with his wife, I would say, which is where we find you.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great sort of psychological character study, as well as all the exciting bells and whistles. And I know Michael had you doing lots of prep across the board for it. I just want to get something straight, because I've read or heard once or twice that one of the things you did was to go out racing cars mm-hmm. beforehand. Am I right in thinking, unless I misinterpret something, that you were racing very old cars, like old school period?
No, newer cars. Okay. We only raced one car, or only drove, I should say, one car that was in the movie. That was the chassis, but it still had the internals of a contemporary vehicle, because the other ones are so old and so expensive that we would actually have some of the original cars, but not to be raced, just for being in the shot, and for Michael's to get the sound of the engine, because you can't duplicate the engine sounds. You kind of have to get the original vehicle for that. But the cars that we raced were like Rebels or Mazda Miatas in California, and some contemporary Ferraris in Modena. And then drove the chassis of one of the stunt cars that we used in the movie.
So you said raced before and then corrected yourself. What did it involve exactly? How fast were you going? What were you doing?
The chassis, I didn't race. I just drove it on an airstrip, just to get the sense of how dangerous it was in comparison to newer cars. So that I wasn't racing or like for a time.
Okay.
But for the laps that we were running in California, it's all, I'm not racing Michael or a stunt driver. I'm just racing myself to get a good time. you know, just going around the course.
So for that, you said to get a sense of how dangerous it was. What did it feel dangerous?
Absolutely. It's open wheel. You know, so there's no roll cage. There's no seat belts. Shifter is on the left and way down and almost in the middle. So, and I'm very tall. And so you kind of see right away how close you are to the road, and any kind of obstacle or rock or debris is dangerous. And if you flip over, that's it. You know, game over.
Did you ever get the sense that you might?
No, but I went fast enough to feel how dangerous it was, you know, and you try to like push it a little bit before, you know, the insurance and, you know, cops.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Was this covered by insurance?
I don't think so. Well, it's not encouraged, but you know, it's helpful. It's information. You know, when you're in the car, no one can stop you. So
are you someone in life who does like those sort of hair-raising experiences and going close to the edge?
Like bungee jumping and things like that?
Yeah, anything like that, which feels like you might get yourself in trouble.
Not bungee jumping.
Mm.
But no, not. I mean, I like to drive fast.
Right.
But I don't get to because I have kids often. So whenever I get to drive myself, I try to drive fast. But apart from that, I'm pretty. Yeah, it depends. It depends. Less the older I get, because the consequences are more real than when I was in my 20s.
How do you think? So going that fast and feeling that danger, do you think that did then tangibly translate itself into then what you could put into the film?
Absolutely. That was the key into the character for Michael and for myself playing it, was the mentality of a racer. Having someone who, there's something that happens even in filmmaking where there's so many things that are technical that are going on, but you have to be 100% present and in the moment. You know, if you miss an apex of the turn, then that shaves off time of your score. And so it's all about, you know, this, you know, the never-ending quest of trying to have a perfect, you know, how can I be smoother? How can I my wheels have the most traction, you know?
That's interesting, because he's a fascinating character. As I was watching the film for the second time, I was noticing that every single thing he says and does is with precision and purpose. There's no small talk.
Mm-mm.
He doesn't seem to waste his time doing anything or saying anything that doesn't get him to where he needs to be. To the extent that, and without giving any context or anything, there's something that happens later on in the film. It's a bit of a revelation that comes to him. And he, even then, he's not prepared for the thing to happen, but he doesn't hesitate. And he has this conversation without emotion, almost. Mm. And he's almost like a machine himself.
Yeah.
Is that something that you developed over the course of pre-production? Is that how did you get a handle on what that was and how to do that but still imbue him with humanity, if you know what I mean?
I don't concern myself so much with like how do I make him accessible, you know, or you know what other humans would do. I don't think of it by him being likable or not, you know, not likable, or what someone else would do. His character was someone that our version that we were telling, and the character that we got from, you know, reading about him and talking to Piero Ferrari and going to the factory and talking to the, you know, waiters that served him food, you know, being in the places in the movie there he actually was, is that he was a different person to different people. And he was a person who was aware of his myth, you know, so he would play that part in a sense. But similar to Eraser, he had to be calm on the surface.
Yeah.
And have this constant piston going underneath it all. So when something comes up in the road or in the environment that he wasn't expecting, you know, like his wife, you know, finding out about his mistress, he has to kind of stay in control and project an image of control, even if underneath it's he feels like he's losing control. And we only have like a couple moments in the film where it portrays that vulnerability when he's with his son in the Dino's grave in the mausoleum.
Yeah.
You know, when he's at peace with Lena. And then when you really see him get mad when, you know, when his racers aren't pushing it, you know, when they're not risking everything for the sake of, you know, time.
Yeah. Another thing I noticed when I was thinking about all of that, when I was watching it again, is that,
He even says in the movie that he builds a wall to cope.
Yeah.
You know, because it's pre-psychology, he's He's come with his own coping mechanism of defending himself against the pain of losing people and feeling comfortable to ask them to go out and risk their lives by keeping distance from people. You know?
Yeah, I might be wrong or over exaggerating, but when I was watching, like I say, when I was watching it again, I think maybe he smiles about 3 times in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And usually when he is with his mistress or with his son, he's not happy. I mean, there are good reasons for him not to be happy, but he...
Well, if he doesn't smile, it doesn't necessarily mean he's not happy. I never smile. I always look like I'm mad, and I'm the happiest person in the...
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, you're smiling now. I'll take it as a compliment.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I thought that was really interesting. He's not someone who... I guess he enjoys his job, or at least he gets a lot out of it, but you wouldn't necessarily know it.
Yeah, I don't think that if you came to a film set and saw Michael or myself, that you would get the sense that we enjoy, you know, different strokes, I guess. There's some actors that, you know, like they radiate an energy, and then there's some people, because we're all different, you know, like to stay focused. I think he's more of the camp of he'll celebrate later. He, you know, he has to stay focused now. His favorite car is the next one. You know, it's always looking to what it could be, and he has to find some way, have to find some way as an actor of enjoying it as it goes along. But while we're making it, we're 100% focused on the task at hand.
Just keep moving.
Yeah. And I enjoy that.
Yeah.
I do. I enjoy the pressure, you know, even though it is insane. I enjoy the discipline of having to put in 17 hours for four, you know, because how incredible it is to be making a film.
Yeah. I know you had a lot of actual research from Enzo, from his life, and you went to his house with Michael. I think Michael got hold of his journals.
Mm.
I read the other day that you, or at least Michael, were given the love letters that he wrote actually to his wife later on. Did you have access to all this stuff?
We had access to it. I didn't see the love letters, but we went to the factory and they had letters that he would write to clients where basically like, you know, when's my car ready? And he's, you know, it'll be ready when I give it to you, you know, kind of thing. So we were with Piero. Piero literally opened the doors to his apartment, you know, where we got to see it's right next door to the opera house, like it is in the movie. We went to the barber shop where he got his hair cut. The barber is the grandson of the guy who actually cut his hair. Where the crash was is actually where the crash was. You know, I told this before, but when Michael was scouting that location, an old guy came out and was asking what they were doing and explained that his brother was killed in that car accident, he came out to, and so that's why he came out to see the crash, and that's why it's depicted as it is in the movie. It's his story, you know.
It's the most terrifying car crash I've ever seen on film. You're not involved in that scene for the most part. What was it like for you seeing how Michael had constructed that? Because I remember when I saw the film for the first time, I felt my jaw physically drop when I saw that. I couldn't, but I didn't know the true story.
Mm.
But I could not believe what I was seeing. What was it like for you, obviously, being extremely involved in this film, but not being involved in that scene and then being treated to the end result of that?
Similar to what the effect it has in the movie is that really it's all kind of intellectual until you actually see what the damage, how dangerous it is. You know, we have a general sense of it, but not like that, you know. And there was some footage that he was basing it off of that I saw, you know, of actual car crashes at the time. And he similarly shot it how it was presented, just simply panning with it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's horrific because of how almost seemingly casual, you know, that it's just as simple as a car taking out, you know, a group of people, which makes it all the more. And then when we shot the reaction stuff coming into it, it really just makes it kind of haunting.
Michael's done a couple of interviews for this that have been published already. And he was saying one of the main reasons he cast you was after seeing Marriage Story.
Mm.
Which I thought was really, really interesting, not just for that performance, which I also loved, but just the fact that I think it must be interesting for you as an actor. You make a piece of work and it's all about that project.
Mm.
And then unbeknownst to you, someone like Michael Mann is watching that and thinking, this guy could maybe be Enzo Ferrari.
Right.
And I think there's something really interesting about that, that you're just making that film and then going about your business. And because of that, here you are playing Enzo Ferrari.
Yeah.
What is that like? Because it's kind of like the weird way that the universe works for people in your profession.
That it's all bizarre. Also, I often interact with an audience. It's not theater where I talk to them afterwards. So
yeah.
And that's what's a great thing about film is they're kind of democratic, regardless of any kind of social hierarchy. They find their audience in a way. That's how I saw people's movies when I was 14. They kind of go. They go places that you never would, you know, or seen by cultures that you have no connection to whatsoever. And oddly, the more specific the movie is, the more universal in a way it is, because that means on a whole, it was more human. I hadn't heard the Marriage Story connection, but, you know, right. it is bizarre, you know, because I'm not thinking of like this, Michael Mann's going to watch this and, you know, like, give me, all I'm thinking of is exactly what you're talking about. That's why it is bizarre. Even you watching it and telling me about it, it's bizarre. I don't know why, you know, I wasn't there with you, but I know that you saw it at some point and immediately I'm like, you know, I hope it was a good, you know, you experienced it in a way that, you know, was great and you enjoyed it as much as I love watching movies that are great, you know. It's a very weird – because there's that disconnect and it exists in a time capsule. And then I go about my life and I've moved on. You know, it's weird. Yeah. I'm not answering your question, but –
No, you have.
Yeah.
You have.
All right.
Speaking of moving on, I know you're a massive Michael Mann film and you've said you've always wanted to work with him.
Yeah.
I'm sure he would again. He was saying the other day, and I know this is something that I'm sure is far off in the future. He's been talking quite publicly about wanting to make Heat 2.
Mm-hmm.
And he suggested that maybe the Macaulay character could work for you. So like I say, it's probably a way off, but I'm presuming you're a fan of that film, if you're a Michael Mann film.
I think it's a masterpiece. I think Heat is a masterpiece.
Yeah. Just hearing that from him, what is your take on, I mean, what did you get out of that film and that performance? And is that, can you see what he sees in the relation between the two?
I didn't see what he saw when he reached out to me about Ferrari. I eventually understood what it is that how he wanted to play it. I don't know what'll happen with Heat 2. You know, hopefully, you know, we'll see what happens. But I know that that movie is a masterpiece, and when I watch it again, or The Insider, or, you know, Last of the Mohicans, that I see it, having known Michael, it's hard for me to not watch those movies and see Michael and love, you know, what it is that he brings to cinema. Not only are his movies accessible to everyone, they're incredibly, the subject is totally cinematic, but he doesn't dumb down anything for his audience. He has such great respect that they'll understand, that they will get it, that they're incredibly smart, you know, and to find that balance. And then he just has these movies that are pure, he has moments in these movies that are pure cinema, you know, the shootout in Heat does not work if you don't care about character. Mm-hmm. And you're so invested in them at that point that it means something, you know, which I feel is somehow become a dated idea. Thing about Ferrari is that hopefully by the time you see someone crash, you care enough that you're emotionally invested.
Yeah.
And that's what's great about watching his films. He is so, champion of internal life and character first, and as well researched he is, on a quest for authenticity. It's very much about his characters, and so that's why I love his films.
Yeah, well, this Ferrari is another prime example of that. It is pure cinema. It might be harder for you to see because you're in it and you did the work.
Totally.
But for me, it lines up on the top with the rest of them. So.
Wow, that means a lot.
So, congrats on the film, and thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, that was Adam Driver, star of Ferrari. And now let's get into First Gear and slide straight into the reviews section of the show and talk about Michael Mann's Ferrari.
Vroom, vroom.
Vroom, vroom, indeed. Hell's Bells.
Yeah, so this is Adam Driver as Enzo Ferrari, founder of the car company of the same name, former race car driver turned car maker. And as we meet him in the late 1950s, he is still very much a boutique operation. He's making fabulously specific cars for racers and for, you know, billionaires, essentially, or millionaires at the time, but let's be honest. And he's under financial pressure to kind of keep the company going, to keep his name on it, and looking, and he's basically told your best bet is to sell out to a bigger manufacturer to get that kind of that cash line coming in, to get some kind of stability there. But to do that, you have to show that you can win races. So he's under pressure to win races. He's also in his home life experiencing some, let's call it, upheaval. So yes, his longstanding marriage to Penelope Cruz as his wife is tumultuous because they lost their son a year previous, and they're both grieving, and they're both grieving in different ways, and they're both struggling with their grief. But Ferrari himself is dealing with it, at least partly, by going off at night to his second family, headed by Shailene Woodley, and spending time with his young second son, who as yet does not share his surname, but is about to, you know, he's under increasing pressure to acknowledge this son and give him his name as well. And then he has the job of, you know, training up his drivers, getting them to a position, a pole position, if you will, in the industry, and making his car company the best it can be. So it's kind of high stakes. It's kind of high pressure. It's a really tense film in a lot of ways. You're just like, you get the sense of this guy juggling all these different aspects of his life every single moment of the day, rushing from one thing to the next, having to be a businessman, having to be, a sort of inspiring mentor for the drivers, having to be a leader for the factory, being a husband, being a boyfriend. Hey, maybe try not doing both at once. Just me, my opinion, whatever. And struggling to kind of keep all the balls in the air. And I think that's really interesting. It also has not one, but I would say two of the most horrific car accidents I've ever seen put on screen. This is something that really does emphasize that car racing, especially in those days, but let's be honest, even now, isn't it incredibly dangerous and weird and bad thing to do?
And you've seen Northern Irish road safety adverts.
I've seen Northern Irish road safety adverts. And if you're listening to this and you haven't seen Northern Irish road safety adverts, I highly recommend them. They're horrifying.
Horrifying.
Horrifying. And this is genuinely up there with those. I mean, there is one accident scene in this which will haunt me for a long time to come.
A lot.
And even though I could quite literally sense that there was something coming up in the film, I don't think the film beats around the bush with this. It very much kind of cues up the fact that something is about to go wrong at one point. But I did not see how and why and to what extent it was going to go wrong. That's on me. Anyway, so I was intrigued by this. I felt like I learned something from it. I felt like I was interested in what was going on. But I also find it, I think, a little bit frustrating at times. I feel like it was quite, you know, oh, look, great man of history kind of model of biopics. And it didn't feel like it did anything very daring or innovative, which I kind of perhaps unfairly expect every time that Michael Mann makes a movie. So I just felt it was interesting because I didn't know anything about it. But I don't know if I would have been super interested if I was already a car person, if that's the word, term, whatever.
Transformer is the word I think you're looking for.
Sure.
What do they call them? Tifosos, I believe, is the word. People are into this kind of thing. I'm not a person who really understands motorsports or finds them particularly thrilling. So I did approach this film with a slight sense of dread. And I will say that crash that Helen is referring to, one in particular, I mean, words can't really prepare you for how bad that crash is, to the point where you almost feel this film should come with some kind of trigger warning, because it's spectacularly upsetting. And
the BBFC, of course, is totally fine with that. Fine. But if a rat had been involved
during the crash. I mean, it is incredible. Just when you think it's, oh my God, that crash was terrible, it's like, oh, it gets so much worse.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back on the road.
100%. Yeah. So that is a lot. And I will say, so this is the build up to the Mille Miglia, which is the big big sort of, I guess, 1,000-mile race.
1,000-mile race, well done.
There,
yes.
My Italian dusted off there. You know, that's really thrilling. And actually, the way he shoots the races, it's that there's a real sense of speed and excitement and real danger to it. And actually, you know, that I think he absolutely nailed it with that. The problem is you had to wait the better part of 2 hours to get to it. And I felt that this film spends most of its runtime in first gear. And it takes absolutely ages for it to go anywhere or to move with any velocity or to be interesting, because so much of it is about Enzo Ferrari's personal life. And look, I have no problem with the fact there are a lot of Americans in here doing Italian accents. I respect the fact that they put a lot more effort into it than Chris Pratt did, say, with Mario. But, you know, I just felt I didn't care enough about his personal life, because it's, you know, Penelope Cruz, who is great if underused, you know, is just yelling at him most of the time, deservedly, because he's being a shit. But, you know, so, and then you've got Shailene Woodley, who's like, again, she's slightly irritated with him. Again, deservedly, because he's shit to her as well. So he's just wandering around going, oh, woe is me, I don't have any money, I'm about to go out of business, I like to race, woohoo, fast cars. And then getting yelled at by people. And so there's an awful lot of this sort of like personal life unraveling. But I guess I didn't care enough about him as a person to find that interesting enough. And I was just like, please get in the cars, make the cars go fast, vroom, vroom. And they did, but it took an hour and 45 minutes for that.
And then when they did,
they crashed.
Devastating and horrifying.
Yes, it was. And it was upsetting. So I don't know. It just, I kind of, you see a film about Ferrari called Ferrari, you expect, you know, Ferraris.
Vroom, vroom.
And there wasn't enough of that. Also, we should point out that this is Mann's first film since Black Cat, which, to be fair, wasn't great either. But he doesn't, you know, he doesn't make a lot of films. And he's been trying to make this one for ages, and he has not made a film in a long time. So I guess I was a bit disappointed.
3 stars then for Ferrari. But go in knowing that true horror is going to be unleashed upon screen. Upon screen, as I say in Yorkshire, upon screen. Right, next up is Next Goal Wins. Jimbo, you don't know anything about football either, so was this film completely and utterly lost on you?
Now, were I being incredibly reductive, I would say the second biggest car crash of the week. Hey!
Oh, no, come on.
So, yes, this is a football film, which is my understanding. So American Samoa were, I think it's safe to say, not a great team. In fact, regarded as the weakest football team in the world at the time. So this is back in,
including Everton.
And this is set in 2014 in the run-up to the 2014 World Cup. They are having an absolute shocker in that they just don't score goals. I think they've lost 31-0, which is, my understanding, not a great outcome for a game. And so a Dutch coach, Thomas Rongen, turns out to be Thomas Wrighton. He comes down here. There we go. He comes to basically pull them out of it. And like, he's not supposed to be a likable character. That's absolutely right. He comes in there, he yells at people, he's unpleasant to them. You know, he's like an anti-Ted Lasso when he comes in. But I found a lot of those scenes just quite difficult to care about. And it's not just my lack of interest in football, I think. I just felt that there was just no real investment in, you know, the team doing well, him turning them around. The stakes just felt really, really low. So all the way through, I'm kind of hanging on for these little lighthearted, humorous moments. And they just pretty much buoyed me through the film, just about. But all in all, I just found it a little bit flat and a little bit unengaging.
I think the thing is that the film is bending over backwards to avoid white savior tropes for this story.
I think
this,
they name check, you know, it at one point, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah. They straight up say it. But they are so, and Waititi is so determined to not make this a white savior film that they make Rongen, and they have a lot of fun saying his name like Wrong One. They make Rongen sound just awful. And I think worse than he was. Like, I have seen the documentary this is based on. It was a couple of years ago, but I don't remember him being this unbearable. So I feel like they have, you know, almost been unfair to him, but without really reckoning with the fact that once you take away anything that he brought, then it doesn't really make a lot of sense, I think, as a story. It's like, well, if we're not really crediting him, why is his tenure as coach the bit we're focusing on? Because it is. And I think every other cast member is far more charming and far more likable and far more interesting than him. And I'm not saying that as protagonist he has to be likable or charming. I get that. But I feel like there's a real imbalance here between the guy that we're focusing on and the people we care about. And the film never gets past that, I thought. I find this really a bit blah. There's also moments where I think Waititi, I don't know if he's just kind of lost his touch or if he was just overworked because he signed up for so many different things. But like there's a scene where there's a little background gag in a sort of hospital or in a first aid tent, which is really funny, right? But then the camera keeps cutting back to it. Like it didn't trust you to spot the funny thing in the background, right? And you get to the point where you're like, oh my God, not only have I seen it, but I'm not amused anymore because it literally is in four or five shots. And there were things like that. It just felt like he didn't trust us as an audience to get the joke. And it sort of took away from so much of the funny stuff and so many funny cast members who are doing their best. So I would watch the documentary again, to be honest, if people are interested in this story.
It's worth noting, like Taika Waititi co-wrote this with Ian Morris, you know, the in-betweeners Ian Morris. So like great talent, you know, on the page, but it just doesn't come out. Like some of the jokes are kind of quite acutely unfunny, I found at times. And look, I love an underdog sports story, Eddie the Eagle, Cool Runnings, all of that sort of stuff. Like it's inherently funny when you get someone who's just incredibly terrible at something and you watch them become something. But something about this film just never quite sinks its claws in. And it has slightly odd pop culture references. Like there's quotes from Taken, Total Recall, Any Given Sunday, you know, but again, they don't seem to land with precision. Like if you're going to go to that pop culture well, you really need the joke to land. And they don't. So you're left kind of in this slightly weird hindsight where you're like, I understood that reference, but it isn't funny. So it was just quite disappointing.
Yeah. So just to give you an idea, if it wasn't already clear where Helen sits on this, her squadcast name this week is Next Goal Sucks.
That's a little overstated, but I couldn't think of a, you know, meh verb.
Next goal meh? Next goal meh? So that would
that's
do?
It's not really a verb, is it?
But you're not alone in thinking that this movie sucks or is suck adjacent, Hell's Bells. And certainly this movie, I think, debuted at the Toronto Film Festival, and the word from that was not good. So I think with that, going into this, I was actually more charmed by it than I was expecting to be. It is, without question, I would say, the weakest film in Taika Waititi's filmography. But it still has enough moments where a little bit of the magic seeps through for me, and has enough of a heart for it to work for me. Just about. But this was meant to be the small film that he made, you know, the small Taika Waititi film that he made that kind of returned him to his roots. Obviously, there was Jojo Rabbit after Ragnarok, and that won him an Oscar. But this was meant to be much more in the kind of Eagle versus Shark, Boy, Hunt for the Wilder People kind of wheelhouse for Taika Waititi. But I think something has gone massively wrong at some point. Maybe one day we'll find out what. But let's just put it this way. As Michael Fassbender said in our interview, he shot this film in 2019. Mm. This film was being shot in 2019. It has taken 4 years for this movie to come out. And it's not just simply a case of they had to do some reshoots because Armie Hammer was in it at one point. And when the Armie Hammer kerfuffle broke a couple of years ago, they decided to recast his role, and Will Arnett has replaced him in the film. But the Will Arnett part is so small that doesn't explain a four-year delay. And I don't think necessarily that Taika Waititi then committing to Thor Love and Thunder explains a four-year delay either. I think that something went wrong here. I think that for whatever reason, he was off his game. Something didn't quite cohere in the way that it usually does for him. And I think this is one of those movies that, you know, years from now, you may bring it up to him in an interview and he may go, what movie? Oh, yes, that's right. I remember filming that one briefly. It doesn't feel like his heart is particularly in it. But still, enough moments of charm for it to get a pass from me. But I'm in the 3-star camp, and so are we as a magazine. So we gave us one 3 stars, 3 stars for Next Goal Wins. But James and Helen are very much in the 2-star category offside for this movie. Mm. Offside. Red card. VAR has ruled 2 stars. Next up, we have a film only Helen has seen. It is the return of the master that is Hayao Miyazaki, the great Japanese animation director with The Boy and the Heron, which we are told is definitely his last film this time. We'll believe it when we see it. Hell's Bells, only you have seen this. What did you think of this? 5 stars.
Yes, 5 stars. Yes, 5 stars. It is. It's astonishing. It's weird, even by Studio Ghibli, even by Miyazaki standards. But it's also just incredible. So it starts during World War II with a young boy called Mahito, who is basically woken up in the middle of the night, and it turns out that the hospital where his mother has been being treated for something is burning. So he loses his mother. And then we cut to a couple of years later. It's the final months or even days of the war, and he is moved out to the countryside. So basically, it took me a minute to kind of catch on to what was happening, but basically his dad is remarrying his mother's sister. She is about to have a baby, and he is kind of adjusting to this whole new home life and this whole new world, and still grieving, obviously, for his lost mother. There's a lot of, you know, strange, funny maids and servants around. This is a very, very wealthy family. This is the other end of the spectrum from Grave of the Fireflies. Have no worries about this kid's physical well-being, initially at least. But there's also this heron on the estate, and this heron just keeps turning up near Mahito and sort of almost seems to be stalking him, and seems to be involved with a weird tower that stands in one corner of the estate. And there's just weird stuff going on. And then it turns out that the heron knows a portal to another world, and that maybe Mahito's mother is there, or maybe she isn't, but it's not clear. But he has to go and find out, and he has to know, and he has to search for her. And it becomes a sort of magical Narnia-esque journey where he has to rescue that world almost to kind of rescue himself. It's magical. It's very strange. There's a scene where he's basically being kind of covered by a whatever the collective noun is for frogs. Like, they're just climbing all over him. He's getting kind of swallowed up by like frogs. And that seems to be like almost a portal between worlds. And then it isn't, because somebody interrupts. Like, weird, nightmarish, dreamlike imagery, as you would expect from a Miyazaki film. Astonishing depictions of war and loss and horror, as you would expect from a Miyazaki film. But also magic and weird little dudes running around being weird and being cute and stuff. It just, and so much texture and so many odd characters and cryptic messages, and it's magical. It's literally magical. It is like Narnia. It is like Pan's Labyrinth. It is like the best kind of fairy tale stuff. It doesn't share a lot of characters or the energy or the exact feel of something like Spirited Away, but it has something of the same spirit about it. It has something of the same. Anything could happen, and it will have its own logic, and it isn't necessarily human logic kind of energy to it. It's wonderful. It's really, really wonderful. 5 stars. No notes. Love it. Please don't retire. Please keep making movies.
Which version of this did you watch? Did you watch the Japanese language or the dub?
I saw the Japanese language. I saw the non-dubbed version. That's not because I'm not open to the dub version. It's just that was what was available to me as a critic screening. I will also definitely be seeing the dub version because it is very well done.
Yeah, they've got good dubbers.
Really good dubbers, and also just I think they generally speaking have done a very, very good job with Miyazaki's films, certainly since sort of what Princess Mononoke onwards. So I'm always here for a well dubbed film if that is available. But yeah, I will see it in both. Loved it.
Cool.
The dubbed version has Christian Bale, Dave Bautista, Chema Chan, Willem Dafoe, Karen Fukuhara, Mark Hamill, Robert Pattinson, Florence Pugh, Mamadou Atti, Tony Revolori, Dan Stevens, and a partridge in a pear tree. or a heron in a pear tree in this case. Very, very excited indeed. I have not seen this one. I will be honest, as I'm sure I've said on the show a number of times over the past, Studio Ghibli is a bit of a blind spot for me. I haven't seen many, so I will check this one out with excitement. This might be the film for me. This might be the gateway drug for me. Who knows? We shall see. Anyway, 5 stars. 5 stars then, Helen. Very, very excited indeed.
Amen. Yeah.
On that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by J.A. Bayona.
Ooh.
Director of Society of the Snow, which is a fantastic film as it makes its debut on Netflix. And Joel Edgerton, we have a number of people from George Clooney's Boys in the Boat, including George Clooney, but we might save him for the week after, which is exciting. But Joel Edgerton, who is the star of that film. So not a bad lineup with which to kick off 2024, because that's exactly what we're doing. Next week, folks, the first podcast of 2024 will be podcast 598, episode 598, followed swiftly on Jan 12th by episode 599. And then comes episode 600, the big one, folks. Live show at King's Place in London. We have had confirmed this week a big name guest star who will knock your socks off. And it's very, very exciting indeed. Tickets are sold out for that in the room. But if you do want to see it live, you can buy a streaming pass via kingsplace.co.uk. Search for Empire Podcast and follow the links from there. And you can see it all out of order before we reshape it and retool it in the editing. Very exciting indeed. But until then, until next week, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is time to say goodbye to my two colleagues of such lethal cunning, Helen O'Hara. Goodbye to you.
Toodaloo.
I listened to your podcast today, your pop culture podcast.
That's right. We're just launching because it's dry. Anybody doing dry January who might need support. But we've done a sort of couple of introductory episodes where basically I interview Kat about giving up drinking. And she interviewed Kat Brown, my co-host, and she interviewed me about never having drunk. So just to give you a basic idea of where we're coming from, essentially. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's going live. But the main start, the big launch is on January 1st.
January 1st, exciting stuff. Jimbo, you any podcasts you've hidden up your sleeve?
No, none at all.
Not hidden.
I have 100% ceased all pilot production. This is my Christmas present to you, Chris, is that there are no pilot podcasts during the festive period. Other than the review of the year that went up on Christmas Day. Ho, ho, ho.
I wonder why three wise men turned up at my door on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, each one holding a pilot TV podcast.
Gold, Frankenstein, and Gurr. exciting stuff indeed. Anyway, it is goodbye from James.
Bye. See you in 2024.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off to have some more of that delicious, sweet, sweet Wonka chocolate toothpaste. Mmm, what a way to see in 2024 with no teeth. It's actually very good for your teeth. It is proper toothpaste. I've been told to say that for legal reasons. Anyway, happy new year to all our listeners. I hope you have a blinding one. Not as in, not that you get blinded. I don't hope that, but I hope that you have a cracking year. And not that anything gets cracked. I hope that your legs are totally fine.
Oh boy.
Just listen, just have a fucking good year, okay? All right? What more do you want from me? Thank you for listening, I guess. See you next time. All right? Bye.
Happy New Year.
Jesus.